Hello and thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. The songs we played during the interview have had to be edited for copyright reasons. If you'd like to hear more Conversations interviews, they're all there on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. Or, of course, you can just go direct to iTunes and subscribe to the Conversations podcast. No cost, no ads, it's free.
How's that?
I think
one day I feel so.
Well, look, thank you.
Now, what would be my story if that were the case?
Oh, no, so, that's not what I meant.
You can, but I can't answer it.
And there was this indescribable welter of emotions.
I think
to this day,
I will never accept
it. It was
that.
Like something that
never
just sort of snapped in my head.
And look, I don't know, it's a miracle.
And I hope that the people listening to us will enjoy what they hear.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
It gives me enormous pleasure to say Clive James is my guest today. There's the old saying, and I'm sure Clive is familiar with it, that the fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. Clive James knows big things about lots of things, which makes him a kind of spiky fox or a very charming hedgehog.
Or a cross between a fox and a hedgehog, and the result's a disaster. It's not very smart, and the spikes aren't very long.
Clive's in Australia for the Noosa Long Weekend Festival in Queensland, and his latest book is called Cultural Amnesia, and it's a very large and important book, and by that I mean it's large enough and heavy enough to stun a burglar with, which is the index of these things.
You're right about the size of this book. It's 900 pages thick, and there's a warning out already, don't read it in bed for too long, because if your arms get tired, it'll fall on you and you'll expire. And but I'm very proud of it. It's the summing up of everything I've learned in the last 50 years, and it's written as well as I can, and it's doing surprisingly well, so I'm plugging it furiously because I don't want people to miss out on this just because it's so big. It's as big as you. It's beside you right now, and it is daunting, isn't it?
It's making the bus we're in tilt over to one side, and certainly successful you do want it to be, but you don't want it to kill anyone in bed. You don't need that on your conscience, do you?
Or even to break anyone's foot. You drop it, it'll break your foot. On the other hand, if you read it, it might improve your brain. It improved mine. It took me 35 years to get ready for this book, and it's been 5 years in the writing and the production, and I'm a better person for it, but I'm also I'm extremely weary because it took it out of me. And the remarkable thing is, of course, that I ended up with a book that any publisher in his right mind wouldn't have published because it's strangely organized, as I'm sure you'll mention. But on the other hand, it took off in the United States in April, and now in Britain, and now here. All I can say is I'm very, very gratified.
I suspect that's probably because, like the other great Australian expatriate, Robert Hughes, you have this knack of taking very large and unwieldy and messy concepts and distilling them down into simple, clear English.
It's heaven to hear. You know, Hughes is better at it than I am, but that's what we're both trying to do, yeah. And Jermaine can do that too. Sometimes the result is total chaos, but you know, she can really condense a lot of argument into a short space, which I think is the secret. I think we all got that knack. Back in Sydney in the late 50s. It was in the air somehow. Everybody really wanted to... Actually, the urge to perform actually affected the writers because, you know, you could perform in journalism. So we all have got a sort of journalistic background, I think.
And you can speak in sort of punchy, sub-edited aphorisms.
Nowadays, I'm often asked to give sound bites, and I have the same reaction as anybody else. I stand flat-footed and say, But we did learn to do the soundbite thing on the page. It's much harder to do it here, as you know. It's a very, very difficult thing to sum up a whole argument in a single snappy phrase right off the top of your head. But on the page, I think it's a necessity to be able to compress, to make the sentence memorable. And if this book isn't full of my most memorable sentences, then the title, Cultural Amnesia... was correct, wasn't it?
Not likely. The thing that first arrested me reading the book is the dedication. The dedication is to a group of brave women, most of whom are living, Aung San Suu Kyi, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and the memory of Sophie Scholl. Now, I looked her up in the book because she's there. Sophie Scholl is unknown to most people. Can you just briefly tell me who she was?
Until recently, she was unknown to most people in Germany, but a movie about her... came out in Germany, and a million people went to see it, which spread a lot of news about who Sophie Scholl was. I don't think that movie will ever really make it outside Germany. There'll probably be a Hollywood movie eventually, because as a subject, she's too attractive to leave alone. She was a girl. You can call her a girl and not a woman, because she was 21. And she was the only female member of a little resistance group in Munich in 1942. They call itself the White Rose, the Weiße Rose. All they could do, they had no weapons, all they could do was spread pamphlets against the Nazi regime. And they were caught and they were executed. And Sophie died on the same day as the boys, her brother Hans and the other boys, in Stadelheim prison in early 1943. And the important thing to say about them, and especially about Sophie, was they didn't have to do what they did. They weren't Jews, they were Gentiles. They were protesting against an offence committed by the Nazi regime against their fellow human beings. They didn't have to do it. Sophie didn't even have to die. The Nazis would have let her walk if she just recanted, because they didn't really want her blood on their hands. They knew she was going to be famous.
They offered her the chance to recant.
Yeah, yeah, and to walk away. And somehow they guessed that if they killed this girl, then it would be remembered. And they were right, it was. And the whole world should know. She's a sort of Anne Frank from a different origin and a different fate, in a way, because Anne Frank was going to get killed. Sophie Scholl didn't have to get killed, but she did. And she's an exemplary person, but probably far beyond anything we could hope to emulate. I don't think I would have been a hero in those circumstances. I hope I wouldn't have been one of the beasts, but I think I would have preferred to be one of the sheep, the people who just went along. Sophie Scholl was of a moral character that can only be called saintly. She's one of the turning points of the book, because she puts you on the spot. What would you have done? What do you do when you begin to suspect that the regime you practically were born and grew up in? Because the Nazis had only been there 10 years, but that was a large part of her life, all the waking part of her life. She was only a kid, 21 as being a kid. What would you have done if you'd woken up to the fact that the regime was so terrible that you had to make a protest? Well, the answer depends on your estimation of yourself, and I'm not so sure I passed the test.
Almost no one would, perhaps.
No, I'm afraid not, and we can't depend on heroes. And it's a bit much to even suggest that you can. You can't expect everyone to be a hero. You can expect them to be sensitive and normal and do the decent thing, but that's the limit. And you're in serious trouble when you need heroes.
She went uncomplainingly to the guillotine.
Yes, she did. The person who was there in the room taking notes, who I imagine was the executioner's friend, said, or maybe it was the executioner himself, said he'd never seen anyone go so bravely to the guillotine. And he'd obviously seen quite a few people being guillotined. The Nazis brought the guillotine back from the museum because it was barbarous. There had been no guillotine under the Weimar Republic. The Nazis brought it back. And in Stadelheim prison, they sliced quite a few heads off. But she never complained. It's almost unbearable to think of. You never thought about the beautiful life she might have had, and she would have had, obviously. And she's an inspiration, but there are a lot of inspirations in the book. Of the dedicatees, Aung San Suu Kyi is Burma. She's in Burma under house arrest, will probably spend her life there. I don't think the regime will ever let her out. She will be defeated in the short term, but in the long term, her name will live forever. And Ingrid Betancourt, who's one of the four dedicatees, I think she disappeared in Colombia a couple of years ago. I'm a bit vague as to what's happened to her. I've got to find out. I know someone who knows her. But she was a very, very brave politician who took on her government. And then the Ayaan Hirsi Ali, I think, is probably the most important woman in the world right now.
You see her as in the same class as those other women?
Yes, I do. And she's getting a lot of flack already for being confrontational, because she's doing nothing less than setting out to convince the entire Muslim world that the men have to behave differently towards the women. And she's taken to the point of saying, stop being, dismantle Islam. It's regarded as an extreme position within Islam. And I don't blame them. It is an extreme position. But you know, how do you react if you've been mutilated by a belief? And I have a lot of respect for her. I think she's very brave. And she could well have panicked in Holland when her friend Theo van Gogh, who was killed instead of her, the man who killed her friend Theo van Gogh, executed him in the street, killed Theo van Gogh because he couldn't get to her.
Tried to cut his head off, in fact.
Yes, yes. But there seems to be a recurring theme in this branch of thought, isn't it? To remove the head of the opponent. It's symbolic, isn't it? You know, make sure they don't think again. So she faced that, and she didn't flee to the United States. And she's just enjoying free speech. She's come a long, long way, Ayaan, and I think a lot of her. I see the point of those who say that she's that she's an absolutist, but I can't see how she could be anything else. Politically, it might be wiser for her to moderate her speech, because my own belief about the whole enormous mess that we face is that moderate Islam is facing it. We're just looking on. And one way or another, they have to make their opinion prevail against the extremists. And whether Ayaan is going to help there or hinder, we're going to find out. It might be too much to ask if the whole religion repudiate its central cultural beliefs about the attitude towards women. But I can see why she wants that. Look what they did to her.
Clive James, looking through cultural amnesia, it's a really a cultural history of the 20th century. And right at the heart of it, and the thing we're talking about now, is a real loathing, a detestation of totalitarianism.
Yes. I loathe it because I can see the impulse within me and the impulse within everybody. It's the desire to go to sleep, to switch off your mind, to stop things being complicated. Totalitarianism and all its brands offer the opportunity to simplify life. Just say what the leadership, do what the leadership says you should do. Don't make it too complicated. Destroy anything that you find challenging. This is common to all the totalitarian fundamentalist systems. And I loathe it because it would destroy the thing I like most about liberal democracy, which is its productivity. Part of the productivity is, which is bound to happen, a liberal democracy will always produce things that you don't like. A free society produces things that you don't like. That's a definition of it. And sometimes you just wish you could switch some of it off. You know, you haven't got time in your life to catch up with all the classical music, let alone with all the jazz music and with the pop music. You haven't got time to read all the novels. Can't everybody sort of make it official, slow things down, put a ministry in charge that allows only six novels a year? You know, it's in you, you see, because immediately this sounds appealing. And then you think, well, I'd like to be the guy in charge of that. The Minister of Culture. Okay. It actually happened in the Soviet Union after 1917. Sorry, I'm racing away with myself here. But he's in the book. He was Lunacharsky. He was Lenin's Minister of Culture, in effect, Commissar of Culture. And Lunacharsky got the job of favouring Soviet creativity and all those wonderful painters and constructivist architects like Malevich and Tatlin, all these characters were all encouraged by Lunacharsky. And then I think it was in 1929 that he was given the job of discouraging them. Stalin said, switch it off. And Lunacharsky, instead of shooting himself, switched it all off and realised, I think, possibly what he was after all along, to be in control of things. The controller will eventually reduce your options. That's why they must never be able to perpetuate themselves in power.
Clive James is my guest at the moment, as if you didn't already know, a man who's treating this as one long job application to become Cultural Commissar of Australia. I say give him the job, and from now on you're reading only six books a year.
It's not a bad program, is it? I think you're developing it. Yeah.
Clive, you have a very rational, understandably rational, hatred of totalitarianism and that kind of political bullying and cultural bullying, and an emotional one as well. Do you think, can I get all Freud in on you in a moment and look at something from your own background there? Does this come from some early deep-seated hatred of bullies?
No, I was probably more inclined to join the bullies than I had an answer to bullies. I saw what bullies were doing, and there's only one way to avoid it for myself, because I was quite small when I was a child, and that was to outrun them. And I wasn't quite fast enough over 100 yards, or to sit down and organise a discussion group. And I did the second thing, and I told tall stories, mainly about how I was in the Africa Corps and had helped Rommel defeat Montgomery. The second thing wasn't true, but in my imagination was all very vivid. I held them entranced. That was my method, but I can't claim for myself that I was a natural ally of the bullied. I remember one guy who got bullied once a year. He was tied to the flagpole and pelted with cream cakes. I remember him very well.
Why?
Well, it was because of his owl-like appearance, I think. He had victim written all over him.
Pelted with cream cakes.
Yes, it was somebody's fetish. Anyway, there he was, all covered with cream cake. But the question here is about me. Did I step in and help him? No. And I regret it. And I should have done, even at the risk of my own safety. But the lesson is that on the whole, no, help won't come. But that wasn't the impulse of the book. Now, I think the impulse of the book was an early lesson that fate, the chance, plays a big role, a defining role in history. And my father didn't come back from the war, and my mother brought me up, and I saw the way her life was truncated by this catastrophic event, and it made me see from a very early age how world events affected private lives. And that's one of the big things that's going on in the book. I use things because I didn't want to use the word antinomies. Let's use it.
Okay, go ahead.
One of the antinomies in the book is between history and individual responsibility and creativity. History never stops. If you're lucky, you get born and you get raised in a quiet period. By a sheer stroke of luck, I never had to fight in a war, for example. My father had just died in one. I did national service, but by the time Vietnam came along, I was too old. So I never had to fight in a war. And that makes me think of that Buster Keaton movie where he's standing there and a house falls on him, but the door is open. So there he is standing up. It all missed him. It all missed me. I never had that big test, and I'm very glad that I didn't. But on the whole, history was very, very hard to get away from in the mid-20th century. And I never forget that when I was a kid and growing up in Australia, my idea of a personal catastrophe was to be stung by bull ants. It hurt, by the way. My left foot especially never recovered. At that very, very time in Europe, about 1.5 million Jewish children were being shipped off to the gas chambers for no reason at all except a madman's dream. So I was in the right part of the world. The place to be in the war was Australia. But even then, it was a hair's breadth because, you know, the Japanese army practically got here. And so history was never far away.
You feel that's a profound sense of relief that you managed to almost managed to escape the horror of the 20th century, because you didn't quite, as you say, your father died. Reading where you've spoken about that in the past too, we know that children often take on all sorts of things and feel guilty about them. Children who come from divorced families, for some reason, will blame themselves pointlessly for their parents' divorce. I wasn't enough for them or something. Yes. I was very saddened to read that you blamed yourself for some reason, that you felt some guilt that you weren't able to make it up to your mother.
Freud developed a large tract of his doctrine to the idea that the little boy is trying to get rid of the father so he can enjoy his mother's love undisturbed without a rival. That actually happened to me, and the result is guilt. Yes, but what I'm really trying to make up, all my later life, I tried to make up to my mother the fact that I was a very, very difficult little boy.
Well, I remember...
I couldn't really recommend to any woman being the mother of Clive Chang.
No woman will have to do that again in the foreseeable future. But I remember reading in your book, Unreliable Memoirs, the deep regret you had about the distress you caused your mum by.
Yes.
At a young age, you became an atheist and a bit belligerent with it too.
It was the right thing to do, was to lose my religious belief. I retained all my interest in religious writings, for example, and I'm still very grateful that I had a Bible education. But no, common reason told me that there was no afterlife or controlling hand governing the universe. My mistake was to tell my mother all this. I started to proselytize, and beliefs tend to try and spread themselves. You're so thrilled that you've reached this conclusion, you want everyone to know.
You became an evangelical atheist.
Yes,
holy roller for atheists.
Well, it can happen. It's happened now to Richard Dawkins and to my friend Christopher Hitchens. You know? They're writing whole books pointing out the obvious. To me, it goes without saying, and when it does start being said, I wonder why. Because I can see the benefits of religions staying exactly as they are, as long as they encourage values, as long as they're humanist values, then a religious framework is a desirable thing to have, especially in private life. What I'm suspicious of is a religion joining itself to the state, and so indeed with the founders of the U.S. Constitution and our Constitution. State and religion are divorced, and it's practically a definition of a requirement for civilization that that should be so. There's a lot about humanism in this book. What is humanism? Well, I think it's the connection between all creative things. What are the conditions for it? Well, on the whole, liberal democracy. There might be a version of illiberal democracy that can do it, but I doubt it. There are undoubtedly many nasty democracies, but not as many as there have been nasty republics, and the measure of liberalism is essential. There are all kinds of religious beliefs, of political beliefs, bubbling under in this book, and I hope bubbling to the surface. But people might disagree with those. What I think they can't disagree with is the higher gossip in the book. There's a lot of gossip in the book. It tells you a lot about Bertolt Brecht, who is a great, probably the greatest, most talented example of an artist who backed the communist regime.
And a shocking human being.
Yes,
he was authentically dreadful on every level.
Mm. Not just being abusively intolerant to his own women, but in wearing work shirts, which on very close inspection proved to be tailored out of blue silk.
What a hypocrite.
And keeping his money in Switzerland.
Can I just go back to your atheism back then? You know, many people who have religious belief, they'll have the odd long dark night of the soul where they go, is true? Is there really nothing there? As an atheist, do you ever have a long dark night of the soul when you go, oh, am I missing something? These people I respect have a religious faith, and are they apprehending something that I'm just not seeing somehow?
Oh, sure. You know, I look at a painting by El Greco and think, well, you have to be a Christian to paint that. I'd like to be a Christian again. But you know, in many ways, I am. I retain all kinds of furniture that I got from the church, especially the King James Version of the Bible, which is our great common treasure, in my view. And what Hitchens, I'm going to have this conversation with him when I see him next, well, he says that he wants his own children to be brought up with all this religious furniture, but he doesn't address the question of how they're going to get it if religions are abolished the way he wants them to.
Recently on TV, we had Richard Dawkins, his special against religion on Compass, was shown on the ABC. It was very interesting. Got a huge audience.
He's a bright guy, Richard. Yeah, he gets carried away quite easily against what he sees as irrational resistance. Like most militant atheists, he's appalled by the fact that people can be quite bright and be religious. When it turns out that an astronomer, for example, believes in Christianity, it actually offends him. To me, it doesn't seem unusual at all. But yes, it's the danger. The danger of being a militant atheist is you'll continually be appalled and start getting impatient with your fellow human beings, which is a bad place to be, in my view.
Clive Jones is my guest, writer, poet, critic, all-round polymath, I think that's the word, and film star. And this is one of my favourite parts of your career. Clive, you had a walk-on role in a movie that I think is the funniest Australian movie ever made, Bazza McKenzie Holds His Own.
Yes, that masterpiece in which my friend Beresford and Barry Humphries together, and don't forget Philip Adams, who produced it, they revolutionised the Australian film industry. The modern Australian film industry starts there because that movie made money.
This is the sequel, Bazza McKenzie Holds His Own.
Oh, no. Yeah, I was talking about the previous one, yeah. Let me backtrack here for you. You can see me in the sequel. I was actually in the first one, but I was playing a body lying on the floor over which Bazza stepped over this body. And I put a lot of training into my acting for that role of lying unconscious on the floor. I inhabited the unconsciousness of a drunk. I practiced in front of mirrors. I laid down. And fortunately, Bruce Beresford double-crossed me and went to the close shot of Barry as he stepped over, so I didn't appear on screen. But I was in the movie, absolutely.
You appear in the second one.
Let's get to that.
Which was a triumphant statement of Australian values, and I just want to play you a clip from it. You don't appear in this clip, unfortunately. I couldn't get audio of that, but this is just a moment where John LeMessurier is appearing in it.
Yes.
The great John LeMessurier from
Dad's
Army.
Everyone was in it. Yeah.
Everyone was in it, and he's applying for immigration to Australia, and he meets the immigration board in London, and it turns out to be a bit like a game show.
Hey, what's that, Four Eyes?
Oh, that's the immigration department, mate. Interviewing all the poor old Poms who want to share our incomparable living standards and cultural attainments.
All you've got to do now is pass the Australian culture test.
Right.
Three simple questions, three correct answers, and you go through that doorway to the greatest little country in the world.
Bob, I don't know. You're right on the bell. I just don't know. I'll have to throw that over to the judges, Bob. I'm sorry. What do you think, judges?
Oh, what do you reckon? Is he pushed? Well, don't forget he's a Pom. You can't expect too much on that score.
Please, I beg of you, for humanity's sake, let me walk tall in Australia.
There's John LeMessurier there appearing.
Painting with a broad brush. It's subtle stuff, huh?
I have to ask you now, Clive, is it true, do we still have the best bottle shops, scenery and Sheilas in the world?
The strange thing about the scene is the answer to the first two questions is now an emphatic yes. Australia, which is a small country with only 20 million people, does do a disproportionate amount in all those fields. Yeah.
Bazza McKenzie Holds His Own, directed by your friend Bruce Beresford.
Yes.
And, of course, written by Barry Humphries, with the great Barry Crocker in the role.
Barry, everybody. I was the only anyone who wasn't called Barry.
You might have got a better role if you'd been called Barry, perhaps.
Well, the role wasn't bad. I played a sort of disgruntled Australian film critic. Called Paddy. And into my part, I think Barry Humphries poured all his bitterness against his critics. My role was not very subtle. I stood around very, very drunk making irrelevant remarks, and most of which got cut out in the cutting room. I'm still a bit bitter about it, you know. It was my chance for stardom, but I did get a chance to climb the Eiffel Tower a couple of times and a chance to be near Humphries, who really... The word genius shouldn't be tossed around, you know. It should be reserved for rare cases, but Barry really is, I think, a genius. And while we were filming in Paris on that film, he led an expedition off to a cabaret called the Alcazar, which was the most spectacular cabaret I've ever seen in my life. And I know now by the evidence that that night had a huge influence on the future career of several people. Dame Edna Everidge, Les Patterson, you know, they're all him. And he got a lot of the way things look in his stage show. He got from that fabulous evening, and I was there. But he was extraordinary to be with.
Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Clive, just before I played you an excerpt from the great 70s film Bazza McKenzie Holds His Own, there was one of my favourite lines, and the film is delivered, I think it's by you, right at the end. Bazza comes walking in, you're all sitting around getting drunk in a pub at 11 a.m. in London, knocking back schooners and tinnies, and Bazza walks in and says, geez, the government's giving away money for the arts and for poems and filmmakers and stuff, and you say something like, Christ, that's us, let's go.
And back we go, and we meet Gough Whitlam. Gough was one of the greatest performers in the movie. I'm not so sure he knew what the movie was about.
Well, people forget that at the end of that, very end of that film, Bazza returns with Dame Edna back to Australia and is knighted by the Prime Minister of Australia, Gough Whitlam.
Yes.
That sort of thing is inconceivable.
Yes, it is. It was an extraordinary moment. Gough had that generosity. In retrospect, it was probably unwise. It was the kind of thing he shouldn't have done. But that's why I love him, because of the kind of things he shouldn't have done. That's why I like all the Australian Prime Ministers, the things they should have done. And people started to love John Howard, and, you know, more than half the electorate does, when he went paddling at Nambucca Heads in his rolled-up shorts and the handkerchief on his head. And they thought, he is one of us. See, Paul Keating could never do that. Keating was always wearing the sharp suit.
Clive, you were speaking there of Barry Humphries, and as a genius, very recently I saw his show Back with a Vengeance.
Uh-huh.
And I got the feeling watching that this is his valedictory show. I think this is his final one.
I think Barry probably immortal. He's been around the block a few times by now. He's older than I am, but he's inexhaustible. And he's got other countries to conquer. And I think, you know, he's very big in Norway. They love Dame Edna in Norway. And then there's China, you know. So I don't think he'll stop till he's got them all. He's got Murdoch's ability to conquer the world. You know?
Barry Humphries seems to deeply miss the old Australia that he used to kick so very, very hard against.
No, you've got
the continental restaurants, the men with hats, that sort of thing.
You've got to understand the way that Barry kicked. He always kicked out of love. He was the great noticer. The guarantee of how much he loved the Australia of the Moonee Ponds, suburban stuff, was the way he noticed it. Nobody else had ever seen anything that sharply. And the guarantee of Barry's deep interest in every aspect of Australian culture was the amount that he registered in his mind and reprocessed. If you listen to a Sandy Stone monologue, and Sandy is the impersonation of all the inertia that Barry loathes about the suburban life, it's full of noticed things. There's a great love there. There always has been. He's a very, very poetic nature, Barry. He controls it and filters it through these strange stage personae. But I don't think it's a case of him finally coming to accept what he used to reject. He never rejected it. He was personifying it, bringing it alive to us. The reason why Humphries was a huge artist so soon in his career was he was doing something nobody else had done. He was making Australia intelligible to itself, appreciable to itself. He'd stand up there and talk about, I think it was Sandy that said, snails in the letterbox. Now, everybody in the audience had gone to the letterbox in the morning and found snails in the letterbox. Nobody had ever mentioned it. Yeah. This is pioneering poetic stuff. And, of course, he's still got it.
He does seem to miss that old Australia. He writes about it quite a bit.
He writes beautifully.
Yes, he does write beautifully. And he misses whistling, for instance. He mentioned that in his most recent autobiography. It's hard to say that of many people, too, isn't it? Their most recent autobiography.
Well, I think he's done two, hasn't he? I've done four.
You've done four. You don't seem to miss that so much. You don't seem to resent the changing face
of Australia. I don't think I ever saw that deep. I'm a bit of a surface creature compared with something like Humphries. And I took what I had of Australia. It was 21 years of the best upbringing you could have. I took it with me. It's still with me. It's still my measure of life. But I can be anywhere and still be at home and so on. So I don't miss it because it's still in me.
You have a website. It's a compendium of all sorts of knowledge in your own poetry. And I can't see Barry Humphries having a website.
I bet if Barry did do a personal website, it'd be like nothing else in the world. But you can't do it overnight, and it's going to take time. And my website has been building now for 5 years, and it's only just getting to the shape where I can tell people to look at it, and you'll see where it's going. You couldn't tell what it was before recently. It takes a long, long time. But for me, it's the ultimate means of expression.
Clive, in your book, Cultural Amnesia, you pay attention to things like fashion as well, and I like that about the book. And you take Coco Chanel quite seriously as a character too.
I thought Gabrielle Coco Chanel was one of the most important women in the world because she had an attitude towards clothes, which took them finally out of the realm of possessions only for the rich, and it became a democratic thing. If some poor, ill-paid shop girl could save up enough money for the little black dress, then she could be as fashionable as the fashion princess. This was a democratic attitude to the arts, which I favour. I like everything I do to be at least appreciable by anyone, if not everyone. That's the way she thought about it. She was impeccable in that way, and she was a great. She came from humble beginnings. She was a great patroness of the arts. She helped to finance Stravinsky, for example, and Diaghilev. She wrote very large checks for them.
She did that for women. She democratised fashion women, as you say, and freed them from the bustle and from the corset and all those things as well.
There was a downside.
Was that her intention to do that, though?
Yes, I think so. Maybe her intention was also to make money, but it wasn't until she discovered that fragrances sold, which is the big discovery. All the fashion houses make their real money out of perfume. And until Chanel 5 was a hit, she never made any real dough. But the downside to Coco Chanel was that when World War II reached Paris with the Nazi occupation, she couldn't do without the life of the high life. I suppose she couldn't do without butter and sugar. Anyway, she maintained her connection with the mighty by the worst possible means and formed an emotional alliance with a German official of very high rank. She was a collaborator. And at the end of the war, she was very lucky not to get a head shaved for it. If she had had a head shaved, it would have been a new fashion, the Coco Chanel hairstyle.
We would have had punk I don't know, 40 years early, perhaps. Yes.
She went into exile in Switzerland and didn't come back again for years. And finally she was brought back in because the French realised that couture was a powerful export weapon for them. But she once again presents this moral problem, but the whole of Paris did. Paris was the great laboratory for human behaviour during World War II. There's a lot of it in the book. Camus, my great hero, Sartre, my great villain, who knew each other very well. They had to decide during the occupation how they would behave. The decisions people make under these circumstances are very instructive. And Camus decided not only that he was against the Nazis, straight after the war he decided he was against the communists too, and he wrote a book called The Rebel, which is the very first popular book ever to say that totalitarianism was all one thing. There was no choosing between them. Sartre, on the other hand, never gave up on the idea that Western capitalism was so horrible that there must be something to communism. Even when he knew about the gulag, he said, well, that's the price for justice, as if what was happening in the East was justice. And there were people in the East who knew that wasn't justice. Because Sartre was as foolish as only an intelligent man can be. He's the great instructive example in my book that brilliance is no guard against that kind of moral stupidity. And there's a lot of that in the book.
Clive, this is a big thing for you in the book Cultural Amnesia, the willingness too many intellectuals had to embrace totalitarianism.
Yes. Well, it's a recurring theme, and it probably still is, in my view. It won't go away because there's a terrible tendency of intellectuals to worship power, as George Orwell spotted. That was Orwell's great perception. I think there's a terrible appeal in totalitarianism, fundamentalism, and all extremisms, is that intellectuals see a chance to settle finally their own doubts, because intellectuals live in doubt. The more clever they are, the more they see what the world is like, and the more they wish that its multiplicity could be reduced, and they tend to rather to worship the people who will reduce it. Power worship is endemic among intellectuals, and you have to ask yourself why. There were some, only a few, that found Hitler attractive, but there were enough, especially within Germany. There were a lot of Italian intellectuals who found Mussolini attractive. There were a lot of intellectuals outside Italy who found Mussolini attractive. And if Mussolini had had the sense to stave off Hitler's influence, fascist Italy might have lasted until Mussolini died.
A much, much larger group of intellectuals were happy to support Stalin, well, that's Mao, where that's Castro.
That's where we really get to it, because of far too many intellectuals, a lot of them in the West, as we call it, fell for Stalin, and later for Mao, and still for Castro. They fall for Castro because they still wish there was some vegetarian form of communism, and they think Cuba is it. Anybody who's been imprisoned on the Isle of Pines for 20 years will tell you that there isn't. But the truth is that communism remained attractive to intellectuals in the West right up until the fall of the Berlin Wall. And the influence still lingers. The idea that there's some kind of dream, usually in the East, where there's some kind of naturally just society, which is not ravaged by capitalism and competition and so on. This suspicion of capitalism is perfectly understandable. I've got it too. I don't like the idea of working for a living, let alone a capitalist society.
But you don't want to reorganise society along Jamist principles.
No, I certainly don't. The Jamesism, which was highly developed at one stage, would never have been a runner. But I was getting a bit solemn there. But the reason why the intellectuals in the West fell for communism, not so much, but for so long, remains a big question, which I'd like to tackle in another book, actually, the companion to this one. There's not room here in the studio for another volume.
There's a great quote from Arthur Miller, I'm not paraphrasing him here, but he said something like, communism, he said, is a bit like being forced to watch a play where everyone must applaud and no one is allowed to leave the theatre.
Well, he was spot on, of course, and of course he wasn't exaggerating about the applause in the Soviet Union. At the end of Stalin's speeches to the Presidium, it was essential to go on applauding longer than everybody else, because the first person who stopped was going to be taken off and get shot. It actually happened. So better bleeding hands than to be among those who were seen to stop applauding.
So how long did the applause go for?
Well, indefinitely. And in some ways it's still going for Stalin. People miss Stalin. You see. Why did so many people miss Stalin, not just in Russia but outside Russia? Well, because he was the man in control. And those of us who are not in control of our lives tend to respect the man who is in control. There was always a lingering admiration in Germany for Hitler because he was, get this, decisive. Well, real life forces you into a decision. And it's very easy to cultivate a lingering admiration for the person who is decisive.
Do you think great art can come from a very bad person and someone caught up in a wicked cause? And I'm thinking here of a filmmaker like Leni Riefenstahl, who made those movies, The Triumph of the Will, that celebrate Nazism and it's all its glory. You can't help watch them and think, oh, they're beautiful films.
Well, it depends. It depends what you think of a beautiful film is. There's some beautiful shots in them, but I don't think beautiful films are made up of just beautiful shots. And I would say that Triumph of the Will was obviously an evil movie, and it's not even a very good one. Most of the lighting and the decor in Triumph of the Will is really by Albert Speer anyway. She just shot it, and she really wasn't a very good editor, and she had no sense of story, and she had to dig each of her movies out of a mountain of footage. But the real problem film is Olympia. Olympia is actually a beautiful film, but I think it's beautiful because sports are beautiful. To give her credit, although she may have had some suggestions coming down from Goebbels to go light on the blacks, she had to go light on the Jews. There weren't any. She nevertheless went ahead and shot wonderful footage of Jesse Owens, and he's right there in the centre of Olympia. And if Hitler had had any sense, he would have realised he would never defeat America.
So then do you think then, is that what you're saying then, that if an artist is making a film in a bad cause, that makes it vulgar or always, and does it then mean that artist cannot be a great artist?
It's an extremely tricky question, but I say the answer is yes, there are no bad, good works of art. What's the neatest way of saying evil is a bad impulse for a work of art? The Riefenstahl argument breaks down, even though Steven Spielberg admires her, Madonna, of course, wants to play her.
Of course.
Yeah, Madonna would like to buy the rights in Leni Riefenstahl, it's a fact. One of the ones who did say something in favour of the Nazis was the playwright Gerhard Hauptmann. And later on he was asked why he'd done it, and he said, because I'm a coward. Weil ich bin feige. Well, you have to watch out that isn't you. I really, sincerely, now you've asked me this question, I'm racking my brains for good totalitarian works of art. And all I can come up with are works of art that were produced under totalitarianism, like the symphonies of Shostakovich, some of which were produced to order, but their content couldn't be ordered because it was music.
Clive James is my guest on The Conversation Hour, one of the most voracious and wide-ranging minds of our time, without a doubt, the author of Cultural Amnesia.
Yeah, you almost forgot the title, confess.
No, I sort of had to look across, yes. Because something about the title made me forget.
Amnesia! Yes. It's the coming thing. Remember Amnesia.
Remember Amnesia. That's the war cry of Clive James at the moment. Clive, you write quite forcefully about jazz and Louis Armstrong and his
term. I'm a huge jazz lover, and I'm a popular music lover. There's not enough about rock and roll in this book, and there will be in volume 2 5 years from now. and about its importance in my life. Given the chance, I would trade everything I have done to have written one song for Dusty Springfield, and that's true. But the jazz is important in this book because it's important musically to me, and it's important politically to the history of the United States and therefore of the 20th century, of the world, because so much that happens in the United States affects the world. Jazz was a purely spontaneous, joyous thing, despite all racial difficulties, until about the end of World War II, and then it became a political weapon in the hands of those black musicians who wanted to make music so their music so difficult it couldn't be stolen by the white man. Because the truth about jazz is that it had always been stolen by the white man. The money was made by the whites who owned the record companies. Louis Armstrong, one of the great musicians of our time, Louis Armstrong never made a dollar in royalties on the Hot 5 and Hot 7 records. He got paid up front, and then somebody else made the money forever. They're still making it. I bought the complete Louis Armstrong set in New York a few weeks ago, and I was very conscious that, you know, part of the money I paid would go to whoever owns the rights of the Hot 5 and Hot 7 records, and it wouldn't be the Louis Armstrong estate. It was a disgrace. Yet it was that man, Louis Armstrong, who had every reason to resent white society, which had robbed him all his life. It was that man who listened to Bix Beiderbecker, a white trumpet player, and said, "Those pretty notes, they go right through me." And there is the key to the whole business of how jazz united the races in America. It's taken a long time, but jazz was a big part of civil rights because it was a weapon in the hands of black musicians. And I don't think they were right to make music too difficult to appreciate. I think bebop was a disaster in many ways. But what they were right about is that it was equally appealing to both races. And a great factor here was Benny Goodman. Benny Goodman put the first small ensemble groups together that contained both black and white players. He couldn't do it on stage very often, but he could do it for records. The whole politics of civil rights in the United States is played out, if I can use the term, through the music. And you might say it continues to be played out. It's an endless theme.
Are you saying that that white America was confronted with the fact that black Americans were making this deathless, complex, beautiful art, and had to admit as a result of that that they were...
Yes, it gets you to the second stage of racism. Racism doesn't go away easily. But when you get to the point of admitting that there are some of the people you despise are people you admire, you move to the second stage. you don't stop thinking of the people. But Tiger Woods is doing things for race relations that even in the South, in American South, one thing he's doing for race relations is he can get into the South. And Duke Ellington is one of the great geniuses of the 20th century, in my view, wouldn't go into the South. If he had the choice, he'd stay out of it. Now Tiger Woods can go there. You see, it's a gradual process, and it ought not to be gradual. But the truth is, there's no historical precedent for knowing how to recover from having enslaved a people. Most of the empires that ever did that are gone with those people, are gone back into history. America has survived. And a binding message from a presidential candidate will probably be given by Barack Obama. It probably isn't within the gift of a white candidate to do it.
Clive James, you talk to writers around the place at the moment. They speak very gloomily about the future of the novel. The novel is on its way out, some of them will say, and in whispered tones, sales are down.
You and I have the answer. Reduce the number of novels drastically. Six a year maximum.
When you, cultural commissar stuff
when
again,
you
is
and
it?
I are in control of the cultural commission, the commissariat. People will be paid for not writing novels. And if they promise not to write a whole sequence of novels, they get paid more. And eventually the novel will be driven back before it takes over America. Can you keep up with even the best novels?
Even Clive James believes in central planning here.
Absolutely.
When it comes to...
Put your hand on your heart. Have you read the Booker shortlist novel? Come on.
But in all seriousness, do you think that in 15 years' time or so, I don't know, the publishing industry will shrink right down and become a boutique thing again for a very small group of people?
It ceased to be a matter of experimentation with James Joyce, who took it as far as you could. Experimentation ceased to be interesting after that. What matters with the novel is whether the person writing has got a vision of the world that you're interested in hearing. There was a wonderful Australian novelist called Madeline St. John. I don't know how you pronounce the last name. I knew her at Sydney University in the late 50s. She was small and noisy, and you wouldn't have predicted her to shake the world. She wrote a series of small novels when she was in exile in Britain. She's dead now. A small series of small novels, which I think are perfection. Now, how can you recuperate from what's happened? How can her reputation recuperate from never having happened? There never was a cult of Madeleine St. John. She never won a prize. Will her books be resurrected? I don't know. I think they ought to be. And in my position as cultural commissar, I'll do my best to ensure that they're compulsorily reprinted. But you have to face the fact that a lot of very good stuff might be going into oblivion even as we speak. And there are another 10 novels coming out while we're having this broadcast. And one of them might be terrific. Will we get to hear of it?
Clive, reading Cultural Amnesia, you get a sense at the end, I suppose, you feel a little bit tired. You sort of feel like you've staggered out of the 20th century, which was probably, well, almost certainly the worst century in human history.
I think
history.
It's worse than this one, yes.
You feel a greater sense of confidence about the 21st century?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure, yeah. There are big things going on, but the main question, Fukuyama was quite right, the main question is settled. Liberal democracy is the form to have and the one to aspire to, and most of the problems will arise from the way people do that or how they resist it. But there will be huge problems, but they're more likely to kill people by the thousand than the million. I think the days when one man could kill 30 million people like Mao Zedong are probably over. People will notice. I don't think the satellites will spot it. Youngsters now have to realize the scale by which my generation is measuring things. That you run out of zeros. There are more zeros on the number than you can count. So I don't think that's going to happen anymore. It's going to be nasty, especially in the Middle East. But the world, if it comes to a flaming cinder, if it comes to ruin, will probably come to ruin in a completely unexpected spot. Maybe Kashmir. It's a terrifying thought. And the fact that two different factions of the Palestinians are fighting each other now in the Gaza Strip is enough to make you despair for them. There's a lot of reasons for despair. Of course there are, but not a reason. There's no reason to give up. An awful large section of the world is being very productive and very interesting. Who would have imagined that China would have come so far since Hong Kong? And that Mrs. Thatcher, there's this much despised figure, she was spot on. She knew that if she was handed Hong Kong over, she had to anyway, but it would be a poison pill for China. If they could just be persuaded to leave it alone, it would infect them with freedom, and it's exactly what's happening.
Clive James, fascinating speaking with you today. I feel like I run a marathon keeping up with your amazing mind.
I wrote this book, so we've made the marathon I've run.
Clive, thank you so much.
I loved it.
And his book is called Cultural Amnesia.
Don't forget.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.